We now have Tara Golden, who is a guest researcher at the Work Research Institute at University College of Oslo, Akershus. Recently finished his PhD at the University of Dublin. At AFI, he's been associated to this project, carrying out research on union strategies related to the emergence of the temporary work agencies in civil aviation and the public sector services in Ireland, the UK, and Norway. He wrote his PhD about the position of Italian and Irish unions on European integration and has paid particular attention to the coping mechanisms of trade unions. So please, Tara.
Thank you, Anders. So I'm cognizant of the fact that I stand between you and a little break, which is well deserved. So just bear with me for a little bit longer, and we'll get through this. So I joined AFI approximately a year ago to conduct this this study, and so this also kind of formally ends my relationship with the guys, so I'll try not to get too emotional, but move on. So in terms of structuring the presentation, I'm going to talk about the organizational learning and political strategies in industrial relations. I'm primarily going to focus on Ireland and the UK, and what I'll be presenting to you primarily are kind of tentative results from the fieldwork that I've doing from in Ireland, the UK, but also in Brussels, and then some conclusions. So we've already covered a lot of this, and I spoke with Anders last night and he saw my slides, and he goes, "You can take, you know, we've covered a good bit of what I had as kind of background, which was great, and allowed me to just kind of focus more so." I'm putting kind of meat on the bones. So it has to do with work package 4 within the project, and that was the organizational learning. And what we're taking, what I'm coming to it with is a collective perspective. So it's collective actors and primarily trade unions. A comparative perspective, because we're looking at Ireland, the UK, and also Norway, as well as two separate sectors. But also a transnational perspective, which is becoming a more predominant trend in the temporary work agency industry. So two research questions are driving it. And the first question is, you know, how has organized labor responded to the expansion of temporary agency work? And secondly, what strategies is organized labor pursuing in scale and scope to secure its influence and relevance vis-a-vis temporary agency work? And the second question relates primarily to the transnational perspective. So we've already covered this in terms of the triangular relationship, that it's a temporary agency work is a fillip for employment. It allows flexibility. But even as the OECD acknowledge that temporary work agency employment might be used in some cases as a cheap way to bypass employment protection on regular employment, as well as a means to weaken trade unions and avoid constraints imposed by collective agreements. Now, naturally, this will be of concern to trade unions and perhaps more broadly as well. So, like I said, it's a three-country, two-sector comparison. In terms of the methods, it's document analysis of official union communications and semi-structured interviews with trade unions in UK, Ireland. We're conducting in Norway and also in Brussels for the European level. So I'll won't introduce the unions formally to you just now. We'll come to them in due course. So a brief overview of Ireland and the UK. So they belong to the first wave, unsurprisingly perhaps, of European states to legislate for temporary work agencies in 1971 and 1973, respectively. But as Arrowsmith points out that, you know, by comparison, the definition of legal status of temporary agency work in Ireland and the UK is a little bit more ambiguous than it is in other countries. So for that reason, the Temporary Agency Workers Directive was important in the UK and the Irish setting. Perhaps less so for other countries, because if you just look at the table, you see prior to the Temporary Agency Workers Directive, countries with equal treatment, and there's a good number, the two outliers on the western periphery of Europe, we have Ireland and the UK. And effectively, the Temporary Workers the agency directive brought them into the fold, so in some sense leveled the playing field. However, one difference again between Ireland and the UK, Ireland went a little bit further with regards to the principle of equal treatment, and this was in contrast to the UK. So just the regulatory framework is important. Just a few descriptive statistics to give you on the rate of agency work in the UK and Ireland. Obviously, the UK is if you want, the field leader. It has the largest number, and you can see, really, I suppose the table captures it across time. So the peak was in 2007 in the UK with 4.7% of the labour market. However, it's interestingly, in Ireland in 2010, in the depth of the crisis, there was a peak in agency work, and some of that can be explained by provisions that were introduced when Ireland was a bailout country. So it kind of pushed them towards agency work. But for the UK, it certainly follows the argument that it follows the economic, the business cycle. That thesis remains. So in terms of when we come to looking at trade unions and strategies for agency work, and anyone who has done this type of work will be very familiar with this theoretical framework developed by Edmund Heery. And essentially, at one end of the spectrum, there's exclusion, and at the other end of the spectrum, there's engagement. But in between, there are two other nuanced approaches. So one is regulation, and the other one is replacement. So regulation effectively is the non-representation of agency workers, but engagement with the labour suppliers. And replacement, on the other hand, is inclusion of agency workers, but principled rejection of agency suppliers. We've already looked at kind of healthcare, and the only thing that I would take from this slide is that the defining characteristic, really, compared to private sector, is the political dimension. It's important, and it's also been important in the Irish and the UK settings. There are other things that set it apart, and which, you know, we need to be cognizant of. But essentially, that's what that's where I'd place the emphasis. So, if we take a step back and we look at the impact of austerity on healthcare, because it very much shaped Ireland and the UK. And we see that in both countries, there are pay freezes, there are reductions. However, also in Ireland, and this was kind of at the behest of the Troika, there was also a moratorium placed on no new hires. So what they term natural attrition, retirees leave the workforce, they're not replaced, and also in the UK, essentially the pay freezes and the caps, or rather reductions on pay, the culmination of these provisions is that it kind of pushed hospital managements towards using agency work. So we can see in the UK that, and of course in the political sense, this is a cost which is incurred by taxpayers. So you need to be aware of that. But for hospital managers, it was about, you know, very much doing the task at hand. But we can see just from the Royal College of Nursing in the UK that the total spend was in 2012 to 2013 was 327 million, and in 2013 to 2014, this figure had risen to 485 million, and this is anticipated to increase. So, as you can see from the graph, it has increased significantly. And I suppose the worrisome aspect from the trade union perspective, but not only, is that from a survey that was conducted by one of the nursing agencies of their staff, they found that 63% of them were only doing agency work. And so you have the kind of substitution thesis that effectively agency work is no longer the atypical, it's becoming the increasingly the typical type of work. So for my PhD research, I looked at the construction sector. So even looking at different sectors for me was very much a learning experience. And again, it was pointed out to me, and I perhaps it's obvious at this point, but it wasn't so obvious at the time, that, you know, effectively nursing is a 24/7 profession. There's always been a degree of flexibility within that profession, you know, to cover the various leaves, sick leave, annual leave, and especially maternity leave. So the unions were kind of accepting of it. But again, we see that in Ireland, because of the moratorium, that essentially the number of nurses leaving or not being replaced constituted 13.5 to 14% of the workforce. So again, and these are taken from interviews, that you know, agency is being used as a workforce and not as a short-term gap. So what we have in the what we have both in the British and the Irish systems are framework agreements at the public sector. Trade unions are supportive of this, and generally that's kind of where they stand. They admit that it's incredibly difficult to organise migrant workers, although on the other hand, some of them think that because a lot of agency nurses are also permanent nurses, that they kind of have them in their fold. But in principle, they're against them, as this quote points out. We're against them. Agency nurses, when you leave a nursing workforce subject to plugging most gaps by agency, you leave yourself vulnerable to financial imperatives which supersede clinical needs. And I guess where it's going in some sense is, and I got a sense of it from the other presentations, is that there's a question of safety, health and safety, you know, patient safety, and we see it in the aviation sector as well. The question of safety becomes paramount, and maybe that's the price that's been paid in order to allow for this flexibility. An interesting development, NHS, which is the body which looks over the management of the NHS, they wanted to put a ban on permanent nurses doing agency work. And in principle, the unions agreed with this because they just wanted permanent employment. So this quote from a Unison official said, largely we agree with them, NHS, on the ban. We want permanent staff. They're more likely to be unionized, increases our collective bargaining power. But we ended up objecting to this because some of our members, on account of the pay cap, have been doing agency to top up their income. So we had an outcry for our members about it. So this was an interesting kind of development, that whereas the union wanted to take a principled stand on it, its members, because they were using agency work because of pay freezes to top up on their own salary. So I'm now going to move to agency work in the aviation sector, and what we've seen here is that there's been a gradual deregulation, and we're all familiar with the rise of the low-cost airlines. So this is just a graph to show how it has grown since 92 to 2015. It's been rather spectacular. And of course, they've saved a lot of costs in aviation are fixed. But they're, so savings are made effectively on labor. So we have the Ryanair model and we have the Norwegian model. Now, the Ryanair model is a lot more convoluted and more kind of shenanigans going on, which I won't get into, but I'd gladly speak with them afterwards. Norwegian adopts the more stereotypical approach in terms of the triangular relationship, and this is in the UK. And what's important to bear in mind here is that previously there were three that provided pilots to Norwegian. They were Park Aviation, RP and Confair. They were replaced by OSM Aviation. And once that replacement happened, BALPA, the pilots union in the UK, were able to engage. It gave them a more tangible target. So just the responses they looked to, they said, you know, I mean, although this was a fragmented and unorthodox business model, it wasn't a sophisticated anti-trade union model, which is a reference to Ryanair. And essentially when OSM came on, they were able to approach them. And it ends with what we here we would term as engagement. So they have signed a collective agreement in 2016, 3 years, with increments, with healthcare, with basic benefits. So that was seen as being a success. But BALPA were also cognizant of the fact that other unions in Europe were critical of this engagement because it legitimizes a model, so to speak. So in Ryanair, BALPA and IALPA have tried to organize pilots. One of the, in Ireland, there's no trade union recognition, there's no legislation for that, so they're on the back foot. Management can literally give them the bird, and there's not much that can be done. In the UK, they've tried organizing them, but essentially it hasn't worked out. So what they've, what the concern is, again, is that there's no security of employment. Pilots are on zero-hour contracts. They're working standby without pay. Effectively, the terms and conditions are nothing short of deplorable. So this, I suppose, and I'd direct anybody interested in it, go to the Ghent report, and this highlights the extent of it, but also the safety and how it can jeopardize health and safety. So the trade union response was essentially to create a group called the Ryanair Pilots Group, which is organizing from within. And this is because primarily they can't get trade union recognition because of where Ryanair has its where it's domiciled. And BALPA had tried the traditional route, but it didn't work. So the BALPA representative told me that they tried that, and he said, because of the fear factor, different types of contracts, we thought, let's try and do things differently. The purpose of the Ryanair Pilots Group originally was just to build people's confidence, network communication, and empower crew so that be it in Ireland, the UK, or France, if there was something big enough to unite all the pilots together, the RPG would be able to do that. And if they wanted to conduct any form of action, whatever that might look like, it wouldn't be coordinated by unions. So they're taking certainly a back seat, but effectively that coordination is being done. So by 2017, 50% of the pilots had joined the Ryanair Pilots Group. Their primary goal is to negotiate with management and Michael O'Leary. Good luck with that. Although he did say that if that number was reached in a press conference, he said he would sit down and speak with them. But when they presented the numbers, it didn't materialize. So I'm not going to dwell on this, but the turnover of Ryanair pilots is also quite high, and that's what can make it difficult when it comes to organizing. So essentially the big challenge for this is an ECA official in Brussels, and he was like, you know, when you have a hostile management, they don't want the pilots to speak with one another because it will shift the power balance and they can't play one off against the other, but the pilots must be really willing to cooperate. And that's always a challenge. So that challenge still remains effectively, and that's what he's saying. It still remains in place. It's been in place for 5 years now. They're not too sure where we'll go, but it's still providing a degree of structure, and it is allowing some voice to work. So just some tentative conclusions on it. So I think that temporary work, contingency work, we're seeing all the different nuances with it. And what it is, especially in the UK perhaps, and the number of agency work being chosen as a first preference, is that it's a form of individualized resistance against the denigration of professional standards. And perhaps we saw that as well with the Swedish workers who used that to bargain. So also, and David mentioned this, that the labour intermediaries, they're an established labour market actor currently. So in addition to unions, employers and the state, and that needs to be borne in mind. So in terms of we've seen that a lot of the conventional wisdom, it can be a low wage, low skill, but we've seen also with the professions, with the pilots, with the nurses, that it's becoming increasingly prevalent. And it's like, as Leah said, it's oftentimes a barometer of how things are developing. So, and then finally, so that TWAs pose an obstacle to political efforts to coordinate, mobilize, and build solidarity between workers. However, unions remain relevant, both either for training or also for insurance, and engagement still remains an option. So, thank you.